This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Maria Hinojosa is an award-winning journalist and host of NPR's Latino USA, which began airing on WNPR earlier this month. Yesterday, she paid a visit to New Haven, where she spoke about her experience in the United States. Her reporting has covered the major cultural shift that's been taking place in the U.S. over the last several decades. The growth of Latinos as a political and economic force, but also the refusal of the federal government to truly deal with the issue of immigration. Today, Hinojosa will join us to talk about her work as a Latino journalist and to delve into some of the issues currently facing the community. We'll also be joined by a panel of some regular contributors, voices of the Connecticut Latino community, and you can join us, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can always email us wherelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherelive, and you can always find today's program on our webpage, WNPR.org. Maria Hinojosa is an award-winning journalist, host of Latino USA. You can hear Sunday mornings at 6 and Sunday evenings at 9 here on WNPR. She spoke last night at a forum in New Haven. She joins us from her studios on 125th Street in Harlem. Maria, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so glad to be joining you, John. It's just great to know that you're in Connecticut and I'm in New York, and we sound like we're in the same room.
Yeah, we sound like we're right next to each other. Well, I'd like to ask you about the talk that you gave in New Haven. As you talk about the Latino experience in America, what is it you were telling the crowd here in Connecticut?
Well, you know, what's funny about it, John, is that I don't know if the people who invited me actually knew that I'm part Connecticut. I've had a home, and I clarify, it is not a house. It is a cottage. It's basically a fishing cabin kind of thing. But that's where my family has been spending our summers since 1990. And so we are very much a part of the Latino reality in Connecticut. But what I was saying was that Latinos in Connecticut need to realize that, and particularly those in New Haven, need to realize that they are being watched, that the news that is being made in places like New Haven is having a national impact. Sometimes when you're in the midst of creating things, you're in the midst of a moment in history, you don't realize the impact that it's having. But, you know, we at Latino USA have been covering what's been happening with city ID cards in New Haven since the very beginning. So I think the core message, particularly for Latinos in a state like Connecticut that is so important, we need to flip the narrative. The narrative in the mainstream media has basically been sad, disempowered, disengaged, poor, undocumented. That is all true. But I think that right now what we're trying to do, what people like me, who is, I'm part of the American mainstream journalism, we're trying to say, you know what, it's time to flip the narrative and actually tell what the Latino experience is. And for Latinos in a place like Connecticut, it also means assuming a real understanding of their role now in Connecticut history. What are Latinos doing as they move in the history of and Connecticut being such an important state for the United States of America? What are Latinos in Connecticut doing as part of that, of the part of their work in creating history? So it's fascinating to me.
What are the things that you think that we're missing in telling the story most, as we tend to focus on things like ID cards or immigration? What are the other big trends or stories that you think that the mainstream media just doesn't pay attention to?
You know, John, if you talk to Latinos of many generations, because I'm a professor in Chicago 6 months out of the year. That's the city where I grew up. I was born in Mexico, raised in Chicago. Latinos feel invisible in general. If you watch Spanish language media, if you listen to Spanish language radio, which is very powerful and quite wonderful and has a long history as part of American journalism and radio history in our country. But other than that, I think Latinos overwhelmingly feel invisible. Stories not being told across the board, not just in one area, but across the board. I think that's why Latino USA and its new format of the hour-long format that gave us the room to breathe, that's why it's taking off, is because we're talking about multiple issues. Because the thing about Latinos in the United States is that we're Americans, 100%, you know, 100%. But we have this other thing that's going on. And frankly, now the truth is, issues like immigration, issues like deportation, issues like incarceration, have to be told. As a journalist, I must tell those stories. Those are the stories of our time for the Latino population in the United States of America in the year 2014. And we know that not because of an illusion, but because of the data. Latinos have the highest rate of incarceration now. We have the highest rate of detention, the highest rate of deportation. This is a reality. But on the other hand, you know, there's Rita Moreno. There's Sonia Sotomayor. There is, you know, if you will, Sofia Vergara. All true. Other side of the coin, Latina teenagers have the highest rate of attempted suicide in our country. So we tell all of those stories, and the mainstream media usually just doesn't.
And you've been spending a lot of time in recent months on the program telling the story of, say, the LGBT community. These are important stories for us to tell in the mainstream media, but I think what happens is we will tend to focus on one segment of someone's life and not the totality of the person. When you tell a story about the LGBT community on Latino USA, you're telling a richer, different story that a lot of Americans aren't used to hearing.
We are so proud of the fact that our show now is in themes. Every hour has a theme, and that hour was queer. But yes, we did LGBTQ. We also did the Society for the Paranormal Society in Laredo, Texas, because that's a little queer. but we are so proud of the fact that we did about 19 minutes of coverage about transgender issues, hearing from different generations of Latino transgender folks. And it was just great radio, and it was great storytelling. And yes, they're transgender, they're Latino, and they live in these multiple realities. Here's the fascinating thing, John, about Latinos now, which is really, again, another part of the kind of hopefulness, and I think we embody it on Latino USA, is that Latinos, there's a whole conversation around Latino identity. It's very confusing, frankly. You know, who are we? Are we Americans? So internally, we're having this conversation. And there's been for someone like me, there was a big, like, am I bicultural? Oh, I'm bicultural. Okay, I'm Mexican and I'm American. And then I came to New York and I was like, whoa, wait a second. Oh, you know, I came to school at Barnard. And I was like, wait a second, there are no Mexicans in New York in, you know, 1980. I'm pan-Latin Americanist. Oh, I'm part Uruguayan. I'm part Argentinian. Now I'm in Connecticut. I'm part, you know, Puerto Rican. I mean, it's like the new dynamic for Latinos around identity is that we are ambicultural. So we can be multiple. We can move in multiple identities, and it's okay. So that's why I love to say I am a Latina from Connecticut. Mm-hmm. My home in Connecticut has a name. It's called Boca Chica. Now, any Latino out there is going to be laughing their heads off right about now. They're going to be like, you named your little fishing cottage on a lake in Connecticut Boca Chica? That's the name of a beach in the Dominican Republic. Has nothing to do with what we call Boca Chica. But that's what Latinos in Connecticut do. And I just want us to be owning those stories and telling them with a proud narrative. And that people should hear them with real joy and expectation of the potential of Latinos in Connecticut.
We're talking on the program with Maria Hinojosa, who's an award-winning journalist and host of NPR's Latino USA, which you can hear Sunday mornings at 6 o'clock and Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock here on WNPR. She spoke last night at a forum in New Haven. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be welcoming in some regular contributors to our program to talk about the Latino experience in Connecticut. We'll also take your phone calls at 860-275-7266. I was drawn to an episode of the show that you did around the theme, Won't You Be My Neighbor? As you can tell by the name of our show, Where We Live, we talk about people living next to each other and the way that we live an awful lot. I want to play a clip from an interview you did on this program with author Mirta Ojito about her book Hunting Season, Immigration and Murder in an All-American Town. It tells the story of Marcelo Lucero, who's an Ecuadorian immigrant who was attacked and killed by seven teens in the town of Patchogue on Long Island in 2008. Later, one of his attackers confessed that hunting immigrants was a frequent pastime for his group of friends. Let's listen to a little bit of this interview.
My contention is that these kids were taught from a very early age to dehumanize Latinos. They were taught by what they saw in the media. They were taught by elected officials who, particularly in Suffolk County, were vehemently against undocumented immigrants. And by just the grown-ups in the community, I mean, they grew up in this atmosphere that they're unwanted. We don't want them here. And I have to say, I think with what is going on in the country right now and in Congress, and Congress refusing to come up with a bill that grants citizenship, or that allows, not even grants, allows undocumented immigrants to eventually achieve full citizenship, we're not that far from that time.
And again, that's from an interview on Latino USA with Mirta Ojito and my guest, Marie Hinojosa. Listening to that interview, it's a very powerful story, of course, but it says an awful lot, I think, to us here in the Northeast about what it means to be neighbors with people from elsewhere. Can you talk a bit more about that story and what that sort of resonates with you?
You know, the thing actually that came to mind, John, as I was listening to that interview, which was a beautiful interview, and Mirta Ojito is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly of the New York Times, now teaching journalists, young journalists at the Columbia Journalism School, one of the most important journalism schools in our country. And what came to mind was actually a conversation I had with Cokie Roberts, you know, the seasoned political reporter, NPR, ABC News, around immigration reform and the lack thereof. And the message that, and Cokie, you know, Cokie's Cokie, and I'm very lucky to be able to say Cokie is a friend. And so she was being very honest with me when I said, Cokie, when you see the lack of immigration reform, what is it, you know? She just said, look, Maria, the political message is very clear. We like you. We don't like you. We don't like you. Now, when you experience that as a population that at the same time is the fastest growing, along with the Asian population, the fastest growing demographic in our country, it is a mixed message. So in a place like Patchogue, where I reported actually for CNN, we were in that community. And in fact, what we did realize was that, you know, where are the kids learning it from? They're learning it from their parents. And there were very painful moments that happened in sectors of Long Island. I mean, a firebomb was thrown into a home of immigrants, Mexican immigrants, at 1 o'clock in the morning on July 4th. And they just escaped with their lives. So why are parents saying these things to their kids? How are they hearing it? They are obviously getting it from somewhere in the family or close friends. And the mainstream media does not help. Again, I go back to the notion of the invisibility. It's not just that when we're on, we are caricaturized into these, you know, very, you know, the undocumented immigrant that, you know, Lou Dobbs taught everyone to fear like nothing else. And so what that does is that it in fact separates communities. And I will tell you that in my community where I live, I'm not sure what it's called, but I don't want to really reveal it. But because it's a beautiful community. And my husband is Dominican. My kids are, as we say, Dominimex, Dominican-Mexican New Yorkers. The people who brought us there were Argentinian medical doctor and a biologist and their kids who were, you know, had a summer home. That's how we end up there. And so we are very much, at first, I think people kind of looked at us like, what? But there was a lot of openness and a lot of possibility of dialogue. But still in that community, which is not diverse at all. That is what it is. It's a very teeny tiny town. But the Mexicanos who I have seen there, who are working in the kitchens, they are invisible. And I wonder about that. And so where we live, what does that mean? That means, you know, talking to them. Buenos dias. How are you? You know, every morning you walk into the country diner and the guy's cooking. Just go in. Say hello. Hola. Visibility. So, and that's very teeny. Now, I'm talking about a very specific kind of reality. On the other hand, I think that, you know, in communities, in cities like New Haven and Waterbury, there has to be a much more frontal engagement with this community because we know that it is the fastest growing demographic in our country. So what is going to help Latinos is actually pro-American. And that's the way we have to look at it. And there's a lot of potential, a tremendous amount of potential.
We're talking with Maria Hinojosa, who's the host of NPR's Latino USA, which is heard Sunday mornings at 6 and Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock here on WNPR. She's also a part-time Connecticut resident. She joins us from her studios in Harlem today. When we come back from our break, we're going to be joined by a few regular contributors to us here at WNPR. Diane Alverio, who's the publisher of CT Latino News, Orlando Rodriguez, who is a senior policy fellow at Connecticut Voices for Children, and Isaiah Diaz, who is an attorney and former chairman of the Latino and Puerto Rican Affairs Commission. We're going to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266, where we live, right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're speaking with Latino USA host Maria Hinojosa. She was in New Haven last night, and she was talking about the Latino experience in America. But we want to bring in some regular contributors to our program here. Isaiah Diaz is the former chairman of the Latino and Puerto Rican Affairs Commission, who's an attorney at Dressler Strickland in Hartford. Isaiah, welcome back to our program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to Diane Alverio, who's a publisher of CT Latino News. Good to see you once again, Diane.
Likewise. Glad to be back.
And Orlando Rodriguez, a senior policy fellow at Connecticut Voices for Children and a member of the Progreso Latino Fund, the host of the New Haven Forum, where Maria spoke last night. Orlando, thank you for being here.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here with Isaias and Diane. It's a treat.
Now, we were talking just a moment ago with Maria Hinojosa about the data that we need to look at. So let's talk first about that, about what do the data tell us about the trends of Latinos here in Connecticut?
Well, the Latino population is growing dramatically in Connecticut. It's grown by 50% between 2000 and 2010. But what's also interesting is that the type of Latinos, if you want to call that, is changing. The growth is now not among the Puerto Rican population. The Puerto Rican population is now less than 50% of Latinos. And what we're seeing more are Mexicans and Dominicans, Ecuadorians, Colombians, and probably by the next census, 2020, there will be more non-Puerto Rican Latinos in Connecticut than Puerto Ricans.
So, Diane, what does this tell us about the change then, this reality now, because we have so long identified the Latino community of Connecticut as being a predominantly Puerto Rican community?
Well, it tells us what we've known for a long time, that there's a lot of diversity within the Latino community. And what does that mean for Connecticut? I think it brings a lot of richness. But on a political level, when you think of who the voters are and the Puerto Rican community that's been so established here for so long, we look at who's out there with the leadership, especially in the political arena. The business arena, I see more of many Central Americans, if you look at Norwalk, South Americans, who are the business owners. In the political arena, it's still Puerto Ricans, as much as I can say.
Isaiah, what do you think about that? That's a very interesting point you make.
Yeah, well, I think the one of the main reasons is because we Puerto Ricans don't have the immigration hurdle that other South American groups may have, which is why Connecticut politically is an interesting dynamic and why the immigration issue is not as heavily – it's not as – not that it's not a significant issue, but it's not as significant of an issue as it would be in, let's say, a Florida or in a California or in a Texas, because all Puerto Ricans are naturalized citizens. We have the right to vote, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm wondering, Maria, if you could pick up on that, the way in which this Latino story is different here in a state like Connecticut that predominantly has had a Puerto Rican population until relatively recently. How is the story of the experience different here than it may be in the other states of the nation that you cover?
In fact, what I think is that Connecticut has a real possibility, Latinos in Connecticut have a real possibility for teaching lessons. So what does it look like when you have that particular diversity of the demographic? It's not easy. I mean, again, what we've been saying on Latino USA is that, you know, we're at the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding Latinos because we are so incredibly complex. We're, you know, in the United States, we become Latinos, all of us. When I'm in Mexico, I'm Mexican and my husband is Dominican. When we're here in the United States, we're Latinos. It's complex and the power dynamics are complicated. So what happens in terms of the Puerto Rican political representation that Diane was talking about in terms of their understanding that they are representing all of Connecticut, and now part of that Connecticut means understanding what Mexicanos need, those of them who are not citizens yet. It's important also to remember that Puerto Ricans are born American citizens. And so, you know, Puerto Rico, if you flip the narrative again, yes, it has dire economic problems and many problems, but Puerto Rico has the highest rate of voter participation rate of any place on the Western Hemisphere. Everyone in Puerto Rico votes. They have – it's a hugely politicized island. And so that is also part of the future of American politics in our country because we have a Supreme Court justice who's Puerto Rican. We are increasingly having more Puerto Ricans at high levels of engagement. On the other hand, you know, I'm thinking Danbury. That's a community that I know well, very Brazilian. They are also part of the Latino community, but I'm not sure what their rate of political participation rate is at this point.
Diane, did you want to jump
well,
in?
Well, I'm just nodding my head away here, Maria, because you're absolutely right. You know, my family came from Puerto Rico in the 50s, and we were so accustomed to anybody who was Latino was Puerto Rican. And in recent years, obviously, that's changed, and through CT Latino, we see so much more. And there's a natural curiosity. We have an opportunity to learn about each other. As a matter of fact, on CT Latino today, we have a story on Ecuador. Now, that was a private personal trip that I took, but I went and I thought, I need to share this with the Latinos in Connecticut. We share that common language. We share some common history, but there's such beautiful distinctions and there's so much that we really need to learn about each other. And as a matter of fact, we're going to be starting a series along these lines. One of our talented writers, Wayne Jibian, is going to be putting this together, which is focusing on the different groups, Colombians, Mexicans, Cubans, Dominicans. And we'll do that because it's important that our readers, Latinos and non-Latinos, become familiar with who we all are.
And what do we know, Orlando, about the issues that are most important to these different groups? Because as we begin to grapple with the idea that Latinos are not one monolithic community, that indeed they come from various parts of the world, what do we know about the things that these groups care about in their individual communities?
Well, as I say, it says it's a diversity. For example, Puerto Ricans aren't necessarily concerned about immigration. There's no reason for them to be. Non-Puerto Ricans, some may be concerned about immigration, but if you're – not every non-Puerto Rican here is – well, let's put it another way. Most Latinos here are here legally, okay? They're legal residents. They may not be citizens, which means they cannot vote. But they're probably concerned about the same things everybody else is, which is a job. and for example, Puerto Ricans are now leaving Connecticut, and we don't know for sure where they're going. My guess is that they're going to Florida. There's been a lot of Puerto Ricans moving to Florida. So it's, you know, one group's concerned, you know, one group is concerned about immigration. The other groups, most everybody's concerned about jobs.
Well, and this is interesting, too. Like right now, we're in the midst of this minimum wage story here in Connecticut. The governor just passed, Isaiah, a 10-10 minimum wage. It's the highest in the nation for any state, taking President Obama's lead. Now, this is something that many people, I'm sure, in the Latino community have been cheering. Many people, I'm sure, in the Latino community who are business owners have had some concerns about as well. It's not just one story when it comes to jobs and minimum wage.
Absolutely not. And I think this goes towards the Americanization, so to speak, of the Latino community. We have our business owners, we have our academia people, and we have our regular citizens as well. Latino small businesses, which is something that LAPRAC has been trying to put a lot of work into, emphasis into, we're kind of in a difficult spot because there's a lot of Latinos that are cheering about the minimum wage increase. However, these small business owners, which I mind you is the lifeblood of the American economy, not everybody can afford to pay somebody $10.10 an hour. Now, granted, the number of people that are working minimum wage jobs is not that significant in the New England area. I think the Department of Labor statistics is something like 23,000 individuals, but don't quote me on that. So yes, it can be an issue and it cannot be an issue. But another thing that's affecting Latinos leaving the state, remember, is the cost of living and the economic opportunity. Places like Florida, places like Texas, a large number of Puerto Ricans are moving to Texas now because there's a lot of job opportunities down there and the cost of living is so much lower.
Immigration, I'd love to get back to that. And yeah, it really ties in with what we're talking about, the diversity of all Latinos and how we are all one group now. You know, I remember when I was asked to write about immigration. I want to say it was about 12, 13, 14 years ago. And I thought, what? That doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect the Latinos here in Connecticut. And I also remember PERLDA, Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, when they started taking on immigration cases, and some of their supporters were saying, well, this is about Puerto Ricans. Why are you taking on immigration? It's changed. Total. The pendulum has swung in the other direction. Right now, and this is what we see on comments, the pulse here in Connecticut of Latinos through CT Latino News, immigration is just, the way it's been handled has been so insulting to all Latinos. It should be insulting to all human beings. It really should. Parents who are deported, sometimes their children end up in the foster care system. There's just so much there that immigration, I would say, has moved much more to the forefront for Puerto Ricans as well.
I'm wondering, go ahead, Maria. I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
So here's the thing. There is a reality right now that Latinos in the United States are living through, but it's important that everyone understand it. So if you are Latino right now, essentially, not by law necessarily, but there is a feeling that at any time, at any point, at any place, any official can ask you, so where are you from? Can you show us your papers? That affects Diane Alberio when she goes to Arizona or Alabama or Georgia. So she's Puerto Rican from Connecticut, couldn't be more, but she could be asked that. At that point, it does become an issue where it has been created because the lack of action, that there is a community that now that feels this. And I'm thinking about Rita Moreno. We had an amazing interview with her on Latino USA, and it was Rita Moreno, 82 years old, one of about a dozen people who are EGOTs in the world, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony winners. She just wrote a memoir. Everyone wanted to talk to her about her love life with Marlon Brando. She came to our studios and she was like, you know what? Yes, I am in a position of power, and I want to talk about these things. And right off the tip of her tongue was immigration. And I was in my studio. I was like, what? That is a reality, because Latinos in the United States of America in the year 2014, while we are having extraordinary successes, we also understand that there is a particular kind of targeting that occurs because you are a Latino. The other side of the coin is that, you know, I call myself a democracy junkie. I'm someone who chose to become an American citizen in the late 1980s. Democracy and engagement means a lot to me. And political participation is not only about going to the polls, as we know it's hugely important for everyone who can and to become a citizen so you can vote. But there's something else that's happening, which is a democratic engagement, a civic engagement by young immigrant rights groups, the Dreamers, who are at this point every day engaging in what previously would have been the civil rights battles of the late 1950s, when, you know, young people were sitting at kitchen counters and no one knew about it. They were just doing it. Mm-hmm. The same thing is happening in this moment in history. We're telling those stories on Latino USA. Much of the mainstream media, like it did in the late 1950s, is missing the story. But eventually it will be told.
Yeah, just to address the targeting issue, we actually had an incident in East Haven, where the Ecuadorian community, which is only about 10% of the community, if that, where they were being targeted by police unfairly. A lot of them were undocumented, but as a result of it, the Latino and Puerto Rican Affairs Commission was able to initiate an investigation along with State Representative Juan Candelaria into the targeting. And now we have the Alvin W. Penn racial profiling bill, but we have it with some teeth, where there's been data collection. Now every time there's a stop, you have to record the individual's race. So with regard to the state of Connecticut, at least, I can't say for the majority of the country, because, of course, the problem is much greater based on the numbers. But there has been strides in the state of Connecticut to try to curtail the targeting.
Yes, and Connecticut Voices for Children, we're really interested in incarceration among juveniles. And we released a report within the past 6 months, and it's really scary. And what it shows is that Latino juveniles in school are arrested at three times the statewide rate. And there's no rhyme or reason as to why it happens. You would think someplace maybe like Hartford or New Haven would have high arrest rates for Latinos. They don't. Okay? It's what the problem is that in Connecticut, there's nothing that says this is an arrestable offense. So by district and even within district from school to school, depending on what the Board of Education policy is or what the principal's policy is, you get very, very large variations in who can be arrested and for what – not who, but for what offense. But Latinos statewide, three times the rate. But fortunately, there's a bill right now. It's gone through the committee process, and it's the juvenile arrest bill. And hopefully it will pass. And what it does is it requires school districts – and police departments to sit down and come up with a memorandum that says you can arrest children for these issues and nothing else. You can't arrest children because they talk back to someone or because they're using their cell phone or, you know, really silly things, which has happened. So we're really hopeful that that will make it through the legislation.
If you go to our website, WNPR.org, you can find a program that we did a few weeks ago about armed guards and police in schools. It is sort of eye-opening, and it goes to just what Orlando was talking about. I want to get to some phone calls. People want to join our conversation at 860-275-7266. Maria is in Ashford. Hi, Maria. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, of course. What's on your mind?
I just want to congratulate Mrs. Hinojosa. I am agree 100% whatever she says, all her points. I'm being in this country for over 30 years. I immigrate from Guatemala. And I want to congratulate NPR because lately they are doing wonderful programs for the Latino community. This morning, I hear the program with about the border.
Yes, and that's been a series they've been doing all week.
Yes, I hear the whole series the whole week, but it's a wonderful thing that NPR is doing, and we need more Maria Hinojosas in this country.
Well, that's exactly what my husband and kids say.
We need more people like you.
Ay, gracias, mamita. Te lo agradezco mucho. Thank you so much.
Y que Dios la bendiga y que siga haciendo un buen trabajo porque necesitamos voces como usted.
Oh, that's so sweet. Muchas gracias. And she's my tocaya. So here's a word that you can now learn. Tocaya means namesake. So her name is Maria. I'm Maria. So I can refer to her actually very affectionately already, though I don't even know who she is, as a tocaya. And it's a very special, you know, the emotion that Maria conveys is quite powerful. There were people in tears last night. I mean, I got a standing ovation, which was surprising to me. It is a very emotional issue. And I love the fact that Maria is saying, you know what? We're listening to public radio and we're hearing it. And that is an important message because Latino USA came to be born within public radio, frankly, because NPR News was not doing as good a job as it needed to do. Mm. We are. We think that there is much more to be done around covering this population that, again, is part of the American story, period, dot, end of story. And to know that those are our future public radio listeners, is Maria and her family and her kids and her grandkids. Those are the people who are going to end up funding Connecticut Public Radio in the future. So it's important for everyone.
Maria, and it's interesting, too, because I don't know Maria who just called either, but she has called my program on a number of occasions on a number of different topics, not just around Latino issues. And as I look across at Diane Alverio, I'll say something that I've said to people a lot, which is when I make a case for talk radio, something that's amazing is that overall, the number of people who are African-American or Latino who listen to public radio is relatively small, and we'd like that to grow. But when we put out a phone call and we say, we'd like you to join our conversation, it's amazing the percentage of people who are easily identified or self-identify as being from another part of the world or from a minority group. People do, Diane, call us and want to talk about these issues. It's remarkable. I know it's something you find in your English language newspaper about Latino issues.
But I'll tell you, the previous times I've been on, I just love hearing people like this Maria from Ashford or someone else from Litchfield or wherever they're from. And so you do have these listeners. You know, Maria Hinojosa was talking about the other Maria, was talking about the emotion last night, and I heard the emotion in this woman's voice too. And, you know, this emotion, I think, has been precipitated by exasperation, frustration. Then we see a lot of people who are just exasperated with Latinos being invisible, Latinos being an afterthought. And that afterthought is a major issue. I was at a dinner the other night with some just really high-profile Latinas here in this area, and that's the talk. Afterthought, whether it's in the health industry, and with all due respect to them, I know that with Access Healthy Connecticut, they have had quite a job, I mean, to move the meter the way they have. Having said that, they started their general campaign in July. They didn't really get going with the Latino campaign till October, and then later it said, well, Latinos haven't been signing up as much.
And there wasn't a website until months after that.
Yeah, until just February.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take a break here in a moment. I want to get to some phone calls. That's one of the topics we wanted to cover a little bit more is Latinos and healthcare. We're talking today with a panel of people who periodically joined us in the program to talk about these issues. Diane Alvario, who's the publisher of CT Latino News. We're here with Orlando Rodriguez, who is a senior policy fellow at Connecticut Voices for Children. Isaiah Diaz is a former chairman of the Latino and Puerto Rican Affairs Commission, and he's a lawyer in Hartford. And joining us from her studios in Harlem, Maria Hinojosa, who's the host of Latino USA on NPR, which you can hear Sunday mornings and Sunday evenings here on WNPR. Back with more of your phone calls where we live right after this. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, after decades of stagnant incomes, the inability to save and disappearing pensions, 75% of Americans nearing retirement have less than $30,000 saved. That's not going to last very long, especially in Connecticut. We're going to talk about how we're retiring today. That's Monday's conversation here on Where We Live. Today on the program, we're joined by Maria Hinojosa, who spoke in New Haven last night. She is a part-time Connecticut resident. She's also the host and creator of NPR's Latino USA. Joining us in studio is attorney Isaiah Diaz, who joins us periodically in the program to talk about politics. Orlando Rodriguez from Connecticut Voices for Children, and Diane Alvario, the publisher of CT Latino News. A lot of people want to join us at 860-275-7266, so let's go to the phones. Jeff's on a cell phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Sorry.
That's okay. You're on the air, Jeff. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been started to work in the construction industry, and I've just realized that there's a lot of discrimination against Latinos and Mexicans. And, you know, if you're like going like the porta potties, like there's all these like slanderous or all these like racial slurs that are like written on the toilets, and you know, you'll be talking with guys, and they'll just be like, oh, those dirtbags or whatever, and it just gets to me. Like, I hate it so much because I see us all as human beings, and we're all here together. And it's so wrong. Because, like, I'm working in the industry for just a little bit here for about a year. It's everywhere, and it's so thick. And it's just, like, there's no changing it either. You can try to talk to them about it, and they'll just be like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. You're a kid. You just started. It's just.
Jeff, thank you very much. Maria, go ahead.
That's fascinating. So, Jeff, I think part of what he said was that they dismiss him. They just say, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just a kid. So obviously Jeff is of a younger generation. And that's what's really fascinating, is that he somehow grew up. So he's the juxtaposition of what we were talking about earlier, a kid who's growing up, you know, hearing adults or media kind of dismissing this population. He's somebody who grew up in a very different way and so understands that they are not the other, that these that they are people. And I mean, it's terrible, but I love that he was so clear about what it looks like. You go in the porta potty. You're working on the same construction site. You go in the porta potty, and who knows what's written on the walls that's against Mexicans. What does that do to you? Does that make you want to become an American citizen? I don't know. So again, and then we, part of what I wanted to say before we took a break, and while Jeff brings up a very specific kind of discrimination, there are violations of due process that are occurring for Latinos across the United States. we have to be aware of this because it is affecting them, as I say, en carne propia. Okay, they're feeling it with their own skin. They're the ones who are being targeted, racially profiled, detained, deported, etc. They are feeling it. But what does it do to the rest of us as an American society that we know that there is active discrimination, hate speak, and violation of due process? And this is a whole other conversation around the immigration detention and deportation policy. Huge violations of basic due process. That should concern all of us. And I think the way what Jeff is saying is that I feel it. It concerns me because I'm a fellow human being. I'm a fellow American. And it makes him uncomfortable to be hearing this talk.
I'm hopeful, Maria, that it's going to change with the younger population now. And I'll give you an example. East of Hartford, there's a town of Manchester. And there's some friction in the town. There's been a lot of new immigrants coming in. But every year they have a 4th of July fireworks show. And it's excellent. We've been several times. I get goosebumps thinking about it because when you go there, there's two big groups of people. You have your older group of people, and they're typically separated by race, right? But the young people, they're mixed up. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and they're walking around hand in hand, arm in arm, having a good time. And for them, there's no difference, right? And I just look at that and I think, I literally get goosebumps. I think, wow, I think we're going to make it. It's just going to take a little while.
Mm. There's actually a tweet who came in from our friend Josh. He says, is there a trend toward diffusion across Connecticut, or will Latinos remain concentrated in cities? He says this will affect political power, but I think it affects an awful lot of this. I'll go to you first, Isaiah. This idea that as we see people in the little town that Maria Hinojosa has a cottage in, that's not very diverse, but you see more people who don't look like you. Do you think this changes things in the state as more Latinos move to the suburbs and the rural areas?
Well, I think, and based on the 2010 census data, I don't have anything more accurate, but there's actually a Puerto Rican living in every single town in the state of Connecticut. Granted, it might be just one family or two families in some of them, but still, that's progress.
That's a good statistic,
exactly.
Isn't it? Yeah, I like
so
that.
So we have to remember that, kind of like with every group, I like to read a lot of history books, and whether it's the Irish or the Italians, when waves of immigrants come in, eventually with each next generation, there's class progression is what I like to call it. And I can easily see that taking place here in the state of Connecticut. My parents came from Peñuelas, Puerto Rico. We all work like animals. And, you know, my brothers, they're doing the same thing with their family. We don't sleep much, but that's okay. And so I can definitely see a trend of more Latinos moving into the suburbs. But remember, these people are also contributing to the economy, contributing to the communities at large. So it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. And also, I think it gets to the story that Orlando was just telling a moment ago, Diane. It's that you begin to see younger generations of people just growing up as people in the cities have long done, living next to each other, seeing the other as just their neighbor, their friend, not somebody different.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think what I'm also seeing that I absolutely love, and certainly in my family as well, is, for example, I met recently with James Hallinan, who's the communications person. He's Mexican and Irish. And we had this fabulous conversation. He's moved into the state, and that's across the board. My own children are Puerto Rican and Irish. And we're seeing this sort of mix. So I do see this new generation moving in a different direction. Having said that, and Maria touched upon this last night at the Progreso Latino Fund event, is that, so what am I? And what we find is that regardless of this sort of acculturation and a bit of assimilation, that Latino identity is so strong. It remains very strong.
I want to get to a phone call here, Jennifer in Middletown, to get us to our next topic before we run low on time. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you so much for the call and the topic. I really wanted to bring up the issue regarding health care. I am a language interpreter, Spanish language, and some of the issues that I see coming up frequently are obviously financial burdens that this population tends to have to bear.
Yes.
Basically, some of the issues that I've seen, for the case that's very prominent, is a young woman who was a victim of rape came in to this medical facility and was unable to openly make better health care decisions for herself. Basically, she was offered a host of testing to, one, prevent pregnancy, HIV testing, other sexually transmitted diseases, and basically ended up just choosing the morning after pill to prevent her pregnancy because she thought that all the cost that would be associated with those other tests she couldn't afford.
Well, and Jennifer, thank you very much for the story, and it's a harrowing story, and we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to get to all of our guests here quickly on this. Orlando, this is just one of many stories that we can tell about the healthcare needs of the Latino population. Is there something that you want to particularly draw our attention to here?
Yeah, I was pretty shocked. I'm honored to have been on co-chair of a legislative task force to look at housing over the past 6 months or so. And we had testimony from Department of Public Health, and we were shocked to learn that in Connecticut, the incidence of children with high levels of lead in their blood is increasing. You know, we all thought lead was taken care of. You know, that issue's gone. It's not. It's actually coming back. And the greatest concentration is in our urban areas, older homes. And we don't know, you know, by race what the, you know, what the numbers are, but given that mostly minorities live in urban areas, the chances are that Latinos and blacks, children, are seeing a disproportionately high number of them with high levels of lead in their blood.
Isaiah?
Yeah, unfortunately, the incident that the caller is addressing is not an isolated incident. That has happened in a lot of places throughout the state, especially in the suburban areas. And there's actually a bill right now that's being worked on in the legislature that could require medical facilities to have some sort of translation service, whether it's in-house interpreters or whether it's the language lines. So we do hear these stories do come back to our commission, and we are taking steps to try to address it. Hopefully we can avoid incidents like the one that was just mentioned in the future.
Maria, we're almost out of time, but I wanted you to weigh in on this. Diane Alveri had brought this up before, the fact that Connecticut, while it's been doing very well signing up people for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, it's not reached out. Like a lot of the ACA hasn't really reached out to Latinos. How big a problem do you see this as?
I think it's a very big problem. You also have to realize that the ACA does not include undocumented immigrants. And for me, it's just like this notion that, oh, I see, the people who would be preparing our food, picking our food, working in the kitchens, they shouldn't have access to health care. How is that good for anyone? It is a big challenge. And I just want to leave with this thought. This is, you know, the story of this woman who was raped. It's harrowing. This is not a Latina story. This is not a Latino story. This is not an immigrant story. It is a story of an American woman. She lives in our country. She is part and parcel of who we are. And that's where it all matters. So if they don't have access to health care, it's not a Latino problem. It's a problem for all of us.
Maria Hinojosa is an award-winning journalist, and she is the host of NPR's Latino USA, which you can now hear on Sunday mornings at 6 o'clock and Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock here on WNPR. She spoke to us today from her studio in Harlem on 125th Street, but she's also a part-time Connecticut resident. And Maria, it was so good of you to join us this hour. Thank you so much for the conversation.
My pleasure. I loved it. Thank you, John.
I also want to thank our guest, Diane Alveri, who's publisher of CT Latino News, keeping sort of a finger on the pulse of what's happening in the Latino community here in the state. Diane, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Always a great conversation, John.
And Orlando Rodriguez, who's senior policy fellow at Connecticut Voices for Children. Good to see you once again, Orlando. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a treat to be here with both of them.
And thanks to Isaiah Diaz, who is attorney and associate at Dressler, Strickland & Hartford, former chairman of the Latino and Puerto Rican Affairs Commission. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.